Hello, welcome to Repast, a food law and policy podcast from the Resnick Center for Food Law and Policy at UCLA Law. I'm Michael Roberts, the Executive Director of the Resnick Center.
And I'm Diana Winters, the Assistant Director of the Center. The Resnick Center performs cutting-edge legal research and scholarship in food law and policy to improve health and quality of life for humans and the planet.
Each month, we'll bring you an interview with thought leaders transforming food law and policy.
Hello, welcome to Repast. I'm Diana Winters, the Deputy Director of the Resnick Center at UCLA Law. And with me today is Michael Roberts, the Executive Director of the Center, and Professor Ernesto Hernandez-Lopez, Professor at Chapman University Dale E. Fowler School of Law. I'm going to turn it to Michael for the introduction. I'll chime in at the end with a few questions. Thanks for being here, Ernesto.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And thank you, Diana, for getting us started today. So, Professor Hernandez, I originally, this idea of having you on our podcast was sparked by my seeing your really interesting opinion piece that you wrote. And so we're going to address that opinion piece today. It was in Al Jazeera and its publication, and it's titled Drop It America and Canada, or Corn Clash with Mexico Helps No One. And I really enjoyed reading it. But before we jump into it, it's probably a good idea that I introduce you to our audience. So you've been a professor at the Chapman University Fowler School of Law since 2005, and you've been tenured since 2011. And you had a really interesting background even before you went to law school. You were a professor at a couple different places in Colombia. You have a long history of working in international development and international relations and political science. But you did go to a law school at George Washington, where you received your Juris Doctorate. And your focus on your research is in international law, post-colonialism, law and food, and immigration. And you published in a number of different publications. And you also publish quite a bit on blogs and opinion pieces. So what you've done here fits right into what you do. And most importantly to me is that you have written a really nice chapter in a book that is forthcoming in November that I've edited on reflections on international or research handbook on international food law. And I love the title of your chapter. If you don't mind, I'm just going to say it now because it really is intriguing. And the chapter is one of my favorite ones in the book, by the way.
Thank you.
But it's Food Law and Third World Approaches to International Law, Ingredients in a Movement, Techniques for Analysis, Recipes for Reform, and a Future Menu. It sounds like a wonderful recipe. And I didn't even bother editing your title because I thought it was perfect the way it was written. So it's so nice to have you here today, and we welcome you to our podcast.
Thank you so much.
So let's get started. I think what I'd like to do today is kind of divide this discussion into three pieces. First, we'll look at the opinion itself that you've written. And then secondly, we'll look at the larger focus of the opinion and some of the more macro issues at play here. So on the opinion itself, why don't you go ahead and set up for our listeners the facts and the dispute, if you don't mind. And then we'll talk more about, after you do that, then we'll jump into sort of talking about what's at stake here.
Great. So the basics that appear in a headline are that the United States and Canada are contesting in the USMCA, which is the updated NAFTA, Mexico's ban on GMO corn. Now, the reality is that Mexico has only banned GMO corn for U.S. consumption. And so that's the specific of the facts. The legal proceedings basically are that there's been two rounds of technical consultations. June 2nd, it's not a coincidence, the day after the President of the United States and Congress can, you know, get over the debt limit hurdle. The United States, soon after that, goes into a second round of consultations, which is basically saying, In 75 days, we're going to start this dispute. So in legal terms, there could be a dispute. It's very likely starting as early as August between the United States and Canada versus Mexico over this. Now, it's just banning GMO corn for human consumption, but what's seen and what's at stake are larger issues. Now, there's a backstory and a forward-looking story that are important legally. The backstory is that Mexico has, through its courts, has banned GMO seeds for corn since 2013, and Mexico's Supreme Court has approved that under Mexican constitutional law. And then if a dispute under the USMCA is carried through, there's going to be challenges just because of how this trade agreement is set up for the United States, Canada, and Mexico to change that policy. So that's the three parts. Seeds have been banned under domestic law. There's a likely dispute over GMO corn for human consumption. And if that dispute comes to a finality, it will be difficult to enforce any remedy.
Thank you. You've done a very nice job at concisely presenting this. In terms of our audience, what's at stake in addition to this issue that you framed? Why should our listeners care about this issue?
You know, let's divvy it up in terms of the three countries at stake. Mexico sees corn, not canola, not cotton, not soy, which hasn't been impacted by any Mexican regulations in this February decree. Mexico sees corn as, you know, significant to its food security, its cultural diversity, its biodiversity. And after the pandemic, you know, having some domestic sufficiency in its most important product. Now, many people think of Mexico as just in its terms of its food, as tamales, as tacos, as pozole, which all use corn, but there's no other country in the world where corn is as consumed. And in fact, the center of origin and the center of diversity is Mexico. And so anything involving corn for Mexico is extremely important. From the U.S. perspective, it's the ironic part that it's the largest producer of corn. A lot of that has to do with GMOs, but not just GMOs. It has to do with industrial agriculture. It has to do with these trade policies. It has to do with a larger growing season and easier terrain. And the United States needs to export corn because, you know, that's what we grow. And any change that I'm advocating would be changing those exports. Now, Canada and the United States are also worried about controls under either trade or domestic law or international law for GMOs. And for Canada, it would be canola. For the United States, it would also be, you know, wheat and soy and other things that are grown. So what's at stake is moving beyond what's currently being proposed to dispute, which is just corn for human consumption. So it's expanding what items could be regulated by trade or domestic law.
Right. So as usually is the case with policy and trade, there are implications in a particular dispute and oftentimes involving potential future regulation of these products. And so precedence is really a big deal here. So you got three countries that are really interested in this issue. Describe for us, please. You made some practical, political, legal recommendations in the piece, and that's what really caught my eye here.
Yeah.
Go ahead and summarize what those are, if you would, please.
Okay, so, you know, let's just assume, which will probably not happen, but let's just assume that for some reason I was in the White House or I was, you know, advising a senator or a chair for an ag committee in Congress. I would say there's four things that we could do. Now, I understand I have the luxury as a law professor to think of things in utopic terms. But first of all, just drop the dispute. The dispute, don't start the dispute. It just has to do with corn for human consumption. Second is to work with Mexican scientists or what the decree calls for, which is international agencies, and a specific equivalent of the FDA in Mexico for what are the scientific, you know, studies or conduct these studies on how GMO corn impacts human health, how it impacts if it's, you know, for animal feed, how it impacts when it needs glyphosate, the impact of long-term GMO use for weed resistance, and also for biodiversity. That's what could be done. Now, I understand that's a bit utopic. Now, in pragmatic terms, what I would say, thirdly, is that the United States should work with, the president through the USTR should work with Congress. On June 1st, 62 GOP members of Congress basically said to the USTR, the trade representative, Ambassador Tai, to start the dispute. So there's 62 members of Congress who care about this a lot. And the next day, the USTR started formal consultations on the dispute. I think there's ways around this. We don't like to talk about it in the headlines. And I think, sadly, academics don't like to talk about it. But there are domestic means. The Trump administration used the Commodity Credit Control Corporation to basically help farmers who were being impacted by decrease in exports to Mexico, not Mexico, but China. This is direct payments. This is food purchase or agricultural trade promotion programs. The United States, under its Farm Bill, which is still being negotiated, always has Title III, which is deals with trade. And there's been trade promotion in the 2018 bill, credit guarantees in the 2014 bill, and funding for market access programs. And so if Congress and the president wanted to support exporting non-GMO corn for human consumption, they could do that. But that's not what they're working on. What they're saying is Mexico wants to stop all GMOs, all corn, and that, you know, USMCA guarantees that. And I say it doesn't clearly guarantee it. And then fourthly, what the USMCA provides for and what this trade treaty does differently than NAFTA or let's say the WTO is basically it says there's going to be a report by a panel, and then the panel report serves as a basis for more negotiation between the countries. And so the United States and Mexico will have to deal with this, not as a court requiring a remedy, but, you know, Mexico's not going to back down, whether it's this populist leftist president or the prior right-wing president or the prior pre-president. They don't back down on corn because corn is very significant. They know that it's a domestic issue, which is probably a larger domestic issue for Mexicans than it is for U.S. farmers. And so the United States could basically cooperate on other issues with Mexico, whether it's border issues or Ukraine issues, in exchange for basically dropping the dispute. And if push comes to shove, the trade agreement is very clear. There's a sunset clause, 2036, and there's, you know, an extension in 2026. That could be brought up again. But at this point, there's no banning of canola. There's no banning of animal feed, that's corn. There's no banning of soy, that's GMO. And so drop the dispute and work with the science or, you know, use our domestic means to help U.S. farmers. But I sadly think that we're going to be in a position where the headlines of Mexico doesn't work with the United States on free trade and U.S. farmers have, you know, a trade right to export is going to be the sad reality of the dispute. And it's going to, you know, not be an easy path despite what the headlines say.
So do you have a prediction on which option you think will happen?
I think what's going to happen is we're going to get to a long road where we're going to end up debating what could be done politically. And I don't think it's an accident that a dispute will probably start in August if, you know, there isn't a path away from that. And that places us in 2024 where this becomes an issue for, you know, any election. And so I think once we get into presidential election season, there's not going to be any agreement between Mexico and the United States. And so we're kind of stuck at that loggerhead. And so, you know, the long road, the tough road would be to get to 2026, where there's a decision to extend USMCA or not. But I do think that, at least for human consumption, Mexico is not going to back down. Now, the United States could look for securities on or guarantees that this won't expand to animal feed and it won't expand to soy or canola. But I don't think that's what's going to happen, because I think the nationalist rhetoric on both sides has taken over.
Yeah, that's interesting. And correct me if I'm wrong, but my experience with these trade disputes, not just with Canada and Mexico, but even with the U.S. and Europe and others, is it typically you do find entrenched political interest. You let it go through the contestation, through the process, and then there's a result. And usually the result means somebody's not very happy about the consequences. And then you start to see the shift take place then. Is that, I mean, that's sort of what you're describing as a most plausible outcome here, and notwithstanding your sage advice to do to the contrary. But do you, am I right or?
No, you're completely right. It, you know, and I think here, at least where I find a lot of illumination, you know, Michael Fakhry, another food law professor, wrote a book called Sugar and the Making of International Trade Law. And what he basically says in that book is that, you know, whether it's sugar as an industry-specific agreement or sugar under an imperial lens or sugar under a multilateral legal order is always going to have vested domestic interests that get in the way of free trade or get in the way of eliminated subsidies. And you know, for the United States and Mexico, early on in the WTO or before the WTO in GATT, there was multiple rounds of debate involving tuna exports and how that treated dolphins. The United States and Canada to agree to the USMCA. And even now we have a dispute over dairy. It never really stops. And so what these trade agreements do or these trade disputes do is it kind of frames how the politics will happen. But if there was no trade agreement, there would still be those politics. And so, right. You know, I think a little realistic look at what the USMCA actually does and what the domestic interests are give us a clear idea of what can happen.
Yeah, no, I agree with you completely. For our listeners, Michael Fakhry is also the special rapporteur for Right to Food at the United Nations and a law professor at the University
Oregon.
Of Oregon. Thank you. We've already kind of segued into the second piece here, which is fine, which is what's the larger focus. So I guess, you know, let me just sort of jump in and ask you a very sort of straightforward question. Why did you write this piece? What are you trying to accomplish? What was your purpose?
My purpose was to try and offer a different point of view than I would say the typical American or maybe the pro-export, because just not American, viewpoint that the USMCA adamantly, clearly, categorically guarantees free trade in GMO corn. And it doesn't. And, you know, I didn't try to offer, you know, the theory or the morality or the politics for what Mexico is doing, but just point to how Chapter 3 of the USMCA just says that the parties encourage the trade in biotechnology. Chapter 24 of the USMCA says it's a sovereign right for each country to have its own domestic environmental law and its own domestic environmental policy. Now, the weird thing there is that the United States and Canada were very worried that Mexico would not follow its environmental law for industrial issues or for, you know, energy. And then lastly, is that even the food safety chapter, which is chapter 9, which is where this dispute's going to be, you know, says that you need to have science-based international standards for any policy on food safety. But it's clear in Article 964 that it says that each country develops its level of food safety protection that it deems appropriate. And so, yes, the USMCA guarantees a lot or protects a lot of trade in agriculture and it encourages trade in biotechnology. But there's a lot of doctrinal normative room for Mexico to say environmental, ag, or even food safety wise in Chapter 9. That it's not a easy case. And so that's what I wrote the op-ed for, was basically saying it's not just Mexico being protectionist and American corn farmers losing, you know, their neighbor and one of the largest importers of corn. It's that the trade agreement, which the United States was very aware that seeds had been banned since 2013, the United States was very aware of what Mexico's position was. And so that's why I wrote the op-ed, was basically to counter the U.S. and, I guess, Canadian perspective.
And not just perspective, but the narrative as well.
Yes.
So let me just key in on the concept of sovereignty here. You use it in your piece. You just referenced it as in context of the agreement. In fact, in your opinion piece, you refer to sovereign right. There's a great deal more discussion about food sovereignty and how it relates to human rights, as well as food policy in a number of different countries. It kind of gets into the heart of the North-South contestation as well over food policy. So food sovereignty, we could actually spend several podcasts on talking about it, but if you can, distill it for purposes of this discussion as to what it means and kind of how this fits into the concept and where are we going from here.
So I'll give 3 points there. And first of all is that Mexico and the decree that bans GMO corn for human consumption refers to soberanía alimentaria, or it refers to seguridad alimentaria. That's food sovereignty or food security. And second, what I referred to in the op-ed was verbatim the environmental chapter that says each country, and I'm a contracts law professor, so that means that the United States understood and Canada understood, and they agreed that Mexico has its own environmental policies and its own environmental law that it could use. And it's just not environmental, it's biodiversity, and it also has to deal with sustainable use for protecting rural communities. And so that's the sovereign aspect. Now, my third kind of illumination on food sovereignty, and this is where it gets big, I see food sovereignty as a term that guides a lot of international food discussion in resistance to trade and resistance to industrial agriculture. But as a law professor, I see it as, sovereignty, even before the term food sovereignty, was always involved with food. And this is a long history. This was just me, writing things down on a napkin. If we look in the 17th century, sugar from the Caribbean was basically exported from monarchical or mercantile sovereign relationships. And whether it's Spain, whether it's Portugal, whether it's France, whether it's the UK, that's what those arrangements were. And then, by 1773, sovereignty is an issue of self-determination. The United States, before it becomes a country, fighting against the taxes that were placed to buy British East India tea. And then sovereignty becomes, from what I'm most interested in, what I've written about from a third world approach to international law perspective, has to do with coffee and Haiti and the Haitian Revolution. And there, slaves revolt because coffee becomes the luxury product that becomes the product that is heavily exported and becomes the moneymaker for France. And the slaves revolt. And they're not allowed to be sovereign as a country for racial reasons. And it's the United States is the first sovereign independent country in this hemisphere. And then it's Haiti. And that pushes us now to 1856. And the first discussion, this is pre-Civil War, of an act of the United States saying, we're going to go beyond our territory. We're going to go beyond our territory. We're going to go beyond where all of us are right now in California to the Pacific. And it's 1856, the Guano Island Act. And the Guano Island Act basically says we can go look for bird and bat droppings that are used as fertilizer to grow more food. And we're going to go beyond our continent. And then in 1898, our sovereignty expands, but what I would say in a more typical way involving food, which is domestic interest wants to limit it. In 1898, the United States goes to war with Spain over Cuba, but sugar interest domestically, beetroot sugar, doesn't want us to have a state that is Cuba. And so we go to war and we expand, but with domestic limits. And then, moving forward, where there's a whole development of domestic and agricultural developments in terms of technology moves us to 1994, where we have, you know, the realism of international law, sovereignty being between the big powers, being claimed to be tempered by international trade agreements. And then in 1994, we have NAFTA, and that has a treaty that says there's going to be a dispute panel if there is a problem involving trade. And then between the United States and Mexico, the United States doesn't cooperate with setting up a dispute mechanism over sugar. And so the mechanism that was supposed to be done for a sovereign dispute over trade fell apart because the United States didn't want to cooperate with those disputes. And, you know, even now, between countries, you know, involving, you know, Slovakia, Poland, Hungary, they're fighting over imports of Ukrainian grains that are too low of a price. And they're claiming that's a sovereignty issue. And so just in international perspectives, I feel that food is always there, whether it's trade, whether it's subsidies, whether it was plantations, whether it was expanding to go find new territories. And, you know, the smart food lawyer or the smart international lawyer is aware that, you know, trade and food are always in the sovereignty discussion. And I think this GMO corn discussion is just one iteration. But, you know, as I see it, it goes back to the 17th century, whether it's sugar or coffee.
That's very interesting. Let me just try to parse this really quickly, because you've given us a lot of content, and I want to make sure Diana has a chance to ask you a couple questions here. Is there a distinction then between the political concept of sovereignty and food sovereignty? Or is it, or are we just talking about political concept of sovereignty and food is involved because of trade and so forth? Or is there a distinction there? Is it like, maybe it has something to do with culture as well, or law, or what do you think?
I think, I mean, I wrote a great deal about sovereignty even before I became like a food law researcher. And so sovereignty basically is just, if you're talking about it domestically, it's, you know, what are the police powers, whether they're from the state level or, you know, the province level or the federal level. There's some legal negotiation there, but it's always in flux. On the international level, it's being recognized as the last and final authority in a territory and the capacity to conduct international relations. So I don't see food sovereignty as either a customary obligation or right. I don't see it as something that's in a treaty. I could be wrong. You know, I'm new to this area. I don't see it being included in, you know, trade agreements or WTO agreements, but it is a political discussion. It's an issue that people say, we're here and either we're Mexico or, you know, we are, you know, Poland or we're Hungary, or even, you know, current trade debates involving GMOs, involving India or Kenya. We want control over our domestic means of how fruit is produced or what we decide is imported. But I think it's more of a political discussion referring to that nebulous, but, you know, always important domestic and international norm, which is basically what's the final authority and do it respect it.
Yeah, yeah. It is interesting to think of it in terms of norm-law relationship when it comes to the terms. Thank you so much. Diana, you had a couple questions as well.
Yes, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much. And going back to some of your conversation at the beginning of the podcast, you had said that trade pacts or agreements frame politics. Even without them, the politics would still be there. Do you see these trade pacts or agreements increasingly used to set food policy and legislation? Is this what you'll be, are you going to follow up on this for your next project? What do you think you'll be working on next?
Thank you. I'll answer that in two parts. As a trade lawyer, you know, if I was back in law school, which is 2001, you say, yeah, look at these trade agreements. They're all being negotiated. Is it NAFTA? Is it the EU? Is it Mercosur? You know, a couple years ago, is it the TPP? Trade's in flux, and it's not just the United States. And so these huge agreements that had, you know, either huge in terms of the parties or huge in terms of what's being agreed to aren't done. And they're actually falling apart. And so the United States pulled out of an agreement with Asia called TPP, which was supposed to counter China. The UK pulled out of the EU. But those food issues still come into play. You know, it was an issue of with how the UK pulls out of the EU, But then it became, what is Northern Ireland's relationship with the UK? So they don't even have a trade agreement. They just have a constitutional arrangement. It was called the Sausage Wars. Right now, the United States is having agreements in 2020 with specific issues, not a huge free trade agreement with China called Phase One. We're negotiating, I would say, smaller agreements over minerals with certain countries. But there is the eye of negotiating, you know, trade agreements with the UK, Taiwan, or Kenya. Kenya, I think, is very clearly a GMO dispute. Last month, an appeals court said that they're banning GMO imports up until the Supreme Court decides if it will be respected. While the United States has already completed with Kenya the first round of negotiations for a free trade agreement. And so the short answer is trade is always there. We don't have the trade optimism, but whether it's sector specific like minerals or country specific like the Phase One agreement with China or the expected agreements with Taiwan, Kenya, or the UK, food will come into play. Now, what am I working on? I'm working on an idea of two perspectives. First is converting this op-ed, converting this discussion into a law review piece or an essay piece that explains this in a digestible way, basically saying that Mexico's claim, Mexico's arguments in a dispute are not, you know, completely dismissed, and American perspectives on free trade are not categorically secure. There's a larger piece at play looking at how food safety codes, phytosanitary and sanitary, and biotechnology rules, I would say, are similar to international law rules that were used to exclude global South countries in the past. Whether that is similar to civilization standards of the 17th, 18th, and 19th century, or whether it's good governance standards of the early 20th century, or whether it's, you know, market access standards of the early 21st century, I think phytosanitary, biotechnology, sanitary rules are similar to that. They're a reason to exclude Mexico or Kenya or India having its control over its food issue. Now, I also work on a different perspective, which looks at American policy generally, foreign-wise. And there the idea, which is similar to this, which is we've been in the United States influenced by and motivated by notions of the frontier. And I've written a piece in the Fordham International Law Journal saying how now our law is more influenced by the notion of the border. And so I do think in terms of, you know, at least for GMO corn in Mexico, what the United States envisions as its border and what it envisions as its motivation to expand as a market is very much at play.
That's great. Thank you. We will look for the longer article or essay. And I'll just note here that I will link in the show notes to this podcast, to the op-ed, to the article you just referenced in the Florida International Law Journal, and also to the Fakhri book that you mentioned earlier. And finally, because we are located at a law school, as are you, we always want to come back to our students. Do you have any advice for students or scholars interested in these sorts of trade fights involving food? Any general topic suggestions you want covered?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same suggestion, whether it's a student who he or she or they wants to think about a career or their project, or a scholar on how to approach something. It goes back to something that I was told that, you know, I really grilled my professor who gave me this advice was, you know, being a lawyer is a combination of a mechanic and a philosopher. And so if I'm thinking about food law and how to research it, it's similar, you know, be the mechanic, but not the mechanic, be the person who understands. For me, it's what's inside those seeds, what's inside the ground, or what's inside, you know, the air that affects what's being grown. But then the philosopher thinks about long-term, you know, is this a rule against science? Is this a rule that's encouraging sovereignty? Is this something that's seen as amoral? Is this something? So, you know, when we research our law, think of the small picture and the big picture. And just for food, I mean, whether it's new technology like CRISPR, or whether it's if we ever have a trade agreement with the UK on how we in the United States chlorinate our beef, or even, you know, at the domestic level, the Supreme Court had a decision, you know, a couple of months ago over the treatment of animals on farms, where basically the majority opinion says that the Dormant Commerce Clause doesn't regulate pork chops. But what, you know, what Gorsuch is saying there is that, you know, just because the Constitution has this doctrine about commerce doesn't mean that California can't have rules on how you treat pigs. And so the big picture there is, okay, how do we treat animals? What is the source of our authority? The smaller picture, or the mechanic, or the butcher, or the animal welfarist looks at how the animals are treated and why that is. And so the short of it is, think of, you know, the granular and think of the big perspective, because I think that's where we can come up with solutions or find the problems.
That's so helpful. Thank you. I love that idea, the mechanic and the philosopher. So thank you. And thank you so much for being with us today. This was fascinating. Again, we will link to your work in our show notes. And thank you to all of you for listening. And we will be back next month.
Thank you so much. It's been a great experience.
Thank you.